Hello and a warm welcome to Radio Prague. My name is Ian Willoughby. We start the programme with the news. Prime Minister Stanislav Gross has said he expects the fate of the governing coalition to be clear by the end of the week. On Wednesday, he's due to hold talks with the leaders of the other two parties in the coalition, which has been in turmoil since the Christian Democrats called on Mr. Gross to resign over a flat financing scandal. Meanwhile, his Social Democratic Party have called on the Prime Minister to dismiss the three Christian Democrat members of cabinet. The state is preparing to speed up the process of easing restrictions on free rents due to the threat of lawsuits from property owners. Deputy Minister for Regional Development Ivan Přikryl told Tuesday's edition of Mladá Fronta Dnes. The move comes after Polish property owners won a case against rent regulation at the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg. Meanwhile, the European Court of Human Rights is considering whether to hear a complaint by a group of young Czech Romanis who say they have experienced discrimination in the education system. The group of 18 Romanis say they were sent to a school for children with learning difficulties in Ostrava for 3 years on the basis of dubious tests. They also say the significance of going to a so-called special school wasn't explained properly to their parents. It could be several weeks before the court rules on whether to hear the case. Czech Airlines expects to more than double its profits this year to 521 million Czech crowns. That's over $23 million, the airline said in a statement released Tuesday. JSA also foresees a 25% year-on-year increase in passenger numbers in 2005. Last year, almost 4.5 million people flew on Czech Airlines, up from 3.6 million in 2003. Meanwhile, the airline has also announced plans to create 400 new jobs at a repair centre near Prague. Czech footballer Pavel Nedved is almost certain to miss next week's Champions League game between his Italian club Juventus and Real Madrid of Spain. Nedved was released from hospital on Monday after suffering concussion in the first leg last week, but has been ordered to rest at home for at least 7 days. The oldest Czech publishing company, founded by the great Czech historian and politician František Palacký in 1831, has been revived. After almost 60 years of inactivity, the Matějice Česká Publishing House has just brought out a biography of Palacký by the historian Josef Pekář. And the weather? The next few days should see temperatures of up to 4 degrees Celsius. There will be sunny spells and snow in places. That's the end of the news.
This is Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio. My name is Pavla Horáková. Coming up today, former Prime Minister Miloš Zeman makes waves once again, this time with his memoirs. Also today we talk to a Roma Holocaust survivor who has just published her testimony, and we look at the latest trends in Czech children's names. In this week's Spotlight, Jan Wellinger takes us to the Bata Shoe Museum in Toronto, Canada. There's more to come, so please stay tuned. The larger-than-life former Prime Minister Miloš Zeman wasn't afraid to mince his words while he was in politics. He frequently employed razor-sharp wit and choice language to put fellow politicians and journalists firmly in their place. But retirement at a cottage in the country does not seem to have mellowed Mr. Zeman, whose no-holds-barred memoirs have just been published, causing quite a stir. Ian Willoughby has been following the story and joins me now. Ian, tell us more about Mr. Zeman's memoirs.
Well, they're entitled Jak jsem si mýlil v politice, that means the mistakes I made in politics, and the mistakes in question, he says, were as a judge of character, principally the character of the current Prime Minister Stanislav Gross, who he accuses of pulling the rug from beneath his feet. Miloš Zeman was the best man at Mr. Gross's wedding, but now he calls him a nevzdělanec, meaning an ignoramus, and he also accuses the Prime Minister of cronyism. For his part, Mr. Gross says he's going to read the book on the toilet. Other former party colleagues come in for abuse from Mr. Zeman, the Minister of Education, Petra Buzková, and also Vladimír Špidla, the man Miloš Zeman chose to succeed him. In many ways, the abrasive style of this book is simply of a piece with Mr. Zeman's approach to politics. Here's commentator Jan Čulík.
Zeman is an interesting story. I think Zeman consciously decided to make it by behaving in a tabloid manner. Zeman realized in the second half of the 90s that unless he really behaves atrociously in public, unless he starts talking in lurid headlines, nobody will take any notice of him and the Social Democrats will not win in the election. Basically, with Zeman, you just had to be outrageous.
And Ian, how have Mr. Zeman's outrageous memoirs been received?
Badly, in general, I think it's fair to say. Pravo, for instance, says the book offers nothing but vulgarity and self-justification. And the Daily also says that the Social Democratic Party now have no real heavyweight personalities, precisely because Mr. Zeman used the party to fulfil his own personal ambitions, rather than build it up into a real political force. And another daily, L'Ordre Fronterizonesse, suggests that he filled the party with wolves, and once he was off the scene, they first turned on each other, and they turned on him as well.
And what about public interest in the mistakes I made in politics? Is it selling well?
It is indeed. It's interesting, the current government crisis, which arose because of a flat financing scandal involving Mr. Gross, may have benefited his former mentor, Mr. Zeman. The book is selling like hotcakes, and copies wouldn't be flying off the shelf at such a rate if it wasn't for the ongoing political turmoil. That's according to one Prague bookseller. So far it's selling a lot. They say it's selling like Harry Potter, but let's hope children aren't reading it.
Many thanks, Ian. Now, only 5 Czech Roma out of every 100 is thought to have survived the Second World War. The vast majority of Romani people now living in the Czech lands are descended from Slovak Roma, their ancestors encouraged or compelled to settle here under the communist regime. It is because there are so few original Czech Romanies alive today that the newly published memoirs of 2 otherwise ordinary women are so extraordinary. Brian Kennedy has the story.
Alina Makhalkova, who turns 80 next year, is very much alive. As a Roma pensioner born and raised in what is today the Czech Republic, that fact alone makes her story special. Nearly all Czech-born Roma who lived through internment in the Czech-run labor camps of Hodonín and Leti later perished in the so-called Gypsy Family Camp at Auschwitz-Birkenau, or were killed in pogroms, or died from disease, abuse, and hunger. But apart from surviving, Alina Makhalkova's history is exceptional on another level. Her grandfather, Pavel Holomek, was founder of the largest Roma settlement in Moravia. He was also among the first Roma to settle permanently in a Czech town and send his children to school. His son, Alina's uncle, would go on to become the first Czech Roma to earn a law degree. His grandson, Alina's brother, would earn 4 academic titles.
Byli jsme silně perzekuovaní, byli jsme tak, že jsme nedostávali za války protektorátu.
Her family, like all Romani people, she says, lived in constant fear throughout the war, at the mercy of German and Czech officials alike, and often went into hiding.
Odvezli ho do toho Osvětimi, jo? Pozor, nesmíme udělat krok, kde nemáme udělat, nesmíme říct slovo.
Listen, we didn't take even a single step that we didn't have to take. We didn't speak a word that was forbidden, because also among the Czechs were traitors, Judases. And there were plenty of them. Just look at the fate of our Mr. Hašler. A Judas turned him in. At night in a village pub, Czech people were singing his song. The next day the Gestapo came for him and took him to Mauthausen, and he never sang again.
Na druhý den pro něho přijelo Gestapo, odvezli ho do Mauthausenu, našeho písničkáře, a už si nezaspíval.
A singer in her own right, Alina was recalling the fate of the celebrated cabaret star and songwriter Karel Hašler, who set satirical anti-German lyrics to the popular melody Ta naše písnička česká, or That Little Czech Song of Ours, and was killed for it.
Všechno nám sebrali, všechno nám sežrali, nechali protektora.
People, throw away your forks. We have nothing to eat anyway, go the lyrics. They took everything away from us, took it all away from us, and just left us a protectorate. Elena knows something about going hungry. Barely into her teens, she spent the early years of the war rising each day at 4 to go work in a factory. Her only wages, food coupons, which were frequently withheld. She survived on handouts from sympathetic non-Roma villagers who knew the family well. In August 1944, at the age of 18, she fled the factory and went into hiding. She had been summoned by the Gestapo, along with her mother, to report for a treatment, which they knew, thanks to a town official, meant forced sterilization. She hid in a cold, dark cellar for 6 straight months.
I had to hide myself to avoid sterilization. My family told people I had been sent to Germany. I saw almost no one for 6 months. It was horrible. I lived in constant fear. But that is how I was saved from sterilization. And that's why I wanted a lot of children. And I had 4.
Much to her father's initial dismay, Elena did not earn a university degree. She raised a family instead, seeing it as a sacred duty given what the Nazis had intended for her and her race. It was her brother Miloš, who had 4 academic titles to his name, who had intended to write the Holomek family story, but he died of cancer in his 40s before he managed to do so. In her late 70s, Elena Michalkova took up the task. Her newly released biography, Elena, The Saga of the Holomek Family, makes up half of a new book published by the Museum of Romani Culture, called Memoirs of Roma Women. The other, A Journey Through Life in a Gypsy Wagon, is by Karolina Kozakova, another Czech Roma who survived the war. She, only because wealthy relatives managed to pay off Nazi sympathizers and buy her family's freedom. Their autobiographies are said to be the first ever written by Czech Romani women.
That report by Brian Kennedy. You are listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio. Now, all over the Czech Republic, expect to hear the pitter-patter of tiny Terezas and the tantrums of boys called Jan. They were last year's most popular names for babies. This was revealed in a report just out, which compared the names of today's Czech toddlers with those of their parents and grandparents. Rosie Johnson sorts the Jans from the Jiřís.
Chtěl bych se jmenovat Jan, být přítel dívek a dám, přicházet k ním nepozván a odcházet nepoznán celé mládí.
So I can say I'm one of the cool kids. Being called Rosamund Therese Johnston, I would automatically fit in at any Czech kindergarten today. The name Teresa was rare in generations past, but today comes top of the list of favourite names for girls. Jan, which is the number one name for boys, has been hovering about in the top 10 for 3 generations at least. Boys' names have changed a lot less than girls' names. This can be explained by fathers passing their names on to sons, which is still a common occurrence in the Czech Republic. Girls' names seem to be more prone to whatever is in fashion at the time. Traditional names like Ludmila and Yaroslava have all but disappeared from the top 10. We'll see how long the popularity of names like Manuela and Esmeralda from Mexican soap operas lasts. Majdalenka, Apolenka s Veronikou, a taky Věrka, Zdenka, Majka, Lenka s Monikou. No jasně, Klára, Hančí, Bára, Mančí, už nevím čí, to všechno byly holky z naší školky senzační. So-called exotic names are particularly popular amongst the Roma minority. In the last year, the Czech Registry Office has added the names Quentin and Cindy to its records as well. Foreign names can sometimes be difficult to adopt into Czech because of the case system and the way that the end of every word changes. Take American Johna Carijo or Johnovi Carimu, for example.
Lenka Jansová.
Vilém.
Já jsem Martina.
Zdeňka.
Michaela.
Jana.
Bohuš.
Markéta.
The surprising thing is perhaps how few really wacky names there are in the lists just published. At least 16 of the top 20 children's names are those of saints, with Katarzyna, Tomasz, Andrzej being Andrew and David being the most obvious examples. The reason there are very few Munyunit Zappa-style names is because, unlike in Britain and America, they must first be approved by the registrar. This is bad news for the girl that was going to be called Midnight Storm, and who must now sign her bank statements rather more boringly as Iliska instead. They're relaxing the rules on what children can be called here in the Czech Republic, and so we will see if a few years down the line, Paris, Apple and Brooklyn all have their own name days to celebrate in the Czech calendar.
My thanks to Rosie or Ruzenka Johnston for that report. And now I'm joined in the studio by a Jan Wellinger, that is, who's just come back from his native Canada, where he spent a month preparing for a series of reports about Czechs and Slovaks living there that will air throughout the month of March. Jan, how was your trip?
Oh, well, thanks, Pavla. It was wonderful, actually. Nothing could have prepared me for finding out just how big and exciting the Czech community in Toronto was. Quite simply, for the month that I was there, I met dozens of people from all walks of life. So some of the people who I'll be profiling, one of them is a concert pianist, another is a journalist, and that kind of thing. And what we're going to hear in just a moment is actually from the very first evening when I met with a couple. And his name is Peter Osika. He's a businessman, and he's one of those who escaped in 68.
You know, I say for maybe 3-4 years, I thought that somebody was going to knock on my door and take me back. Strange feeling about being able to do whatever you want and go anywhere you want and say anything you want.
On a lighter note, how do you find Peter's accent?
Well, I found his accent to be intriguing.
My accent? I don't have an accent.
At first, I couldn't quite figure out what his accent was.
She's not talking to me in French.
And I didn't. That's not true.
I'm just kidding.
That's not true, but.
So that was the first kind of meeting, and as you can see, I gave him a little bit of a hard time about the accent, which is something that people who left Czechoslovakia don't really like. I'm kidding, of course, but yeah, people should tune in if they want to know what life is like for Czechs in Toronto.
As we've just said, today's Spotlight is part of a new series of stories and reports about Czechs in Canada airing on Radio Prague throughout the month of March. In this edition, Jan Wellinger takes us to the exciting Bata Shoe Museum right in the centre of Toronto. Among his guests, the founder of the museum itself, Sonia Bata, wife of famous Czech-born businessman Tomáš Baťa, whose shoes are recognized worldwide.
Another busy day in the heart of Toronto. Traffic passes quickly through the popular Annex District at the corner of Bloor Street and St. George, a corner which is home to the Bata Shoe Museum. Opened 10 years ago, the museum is one of the most visually daring buildings in the city. Giant, modernist shoebox. All angles, all a careful balance of leaning facades and glass, with a lid slightly askew. The Bata Shoe Museum's founder, Sonia Bata, has spent most of her professional life in the footwear business. She married into the Czech Bata family in 1946. And was instrumental in helping her husband rebuild their family's shoe business abroad.
1946 was a difficult year for the Bata Shoe Organization because it was obvious that the Iron Curtain was going to come down, and my husband wanted to rebuild the organization, particularly in the developing parts of the world. He had an outstanding group of young Czech people surrounding him. They all had left Czechoslovakia at that time, and they were passionate in creating another organization, and I wanted to be part of that team. I became involved in product development, and I became involved in store design and factory design, how to make shoes in North End, so that gradually over the years I became quite an expert, and as a result, I love shoes.
Mrs. Bata also began to collect shoes from all over the world, and by the early 1980s, she had collected literally thousands of pairs.
You must realize that when I started collecting the shoes, I never thought of creating a museum. That happened much, much later in my life. What happened was that traveling around the world, I noticed that different cultures wore totally different footwear. And I couldn't figure out why, because after all, the foot is the same the whole world over. We have the same number of bones and tendons and muscles. So why is it that the Japanese, they wear gaiters? And why is it that the Dutch have clogs? And our native people, they have moccasins? And I was intrigued to find out, how is it that in certain cultures, the shoe shapes, they change so much?
The museum's curator, Elizabeth Semmelhack, agrees that what is intriguing about shoes is learning why, historically, a certain type of shoe was made and worn. She took me around one of the Bata Shoe Museum's current exhibitions titled Paths Across the Plains, pointing out the not-so-obvious.
This exhibition looks at plains moccasins and plains shoes from the 19th century. It's a time of incredible cultural change that happens across the Great Plains. The Great Plains cultures themselves are being transformed by white culture that's coming in. And looking at the political things that are going on, you'd imagine that nobody would have the time or the interest to make decorated clothing. But the women respond with this explosion of creative energy. Beads are coming in, different design motifs are coming in. And also, as the cultures change, expressions of status are changing as well. And one of my favorite sections in this exhibition is the Sioux area. And what we're looking at right here are beautifully beaded shoes. And you'll notice that the soles are also beaded. And this, at first glance, seems incredibly impractical. The reason why the soles were beaded was that this was an expression of horse wealth, because you didn't have to walk from place to place if you owned lots of horses. And so again, by looking at the shoes themselves, they can lead you into understanding impulses of the culture, how the women were doing the beadwork, what was inspiring them, and what time period they lived in.
I was also able to see an equally inspiring exhibit now on view called Beads, Buckles, and Bows, 400 years of embellished footwear, including elegantly embroidered shoes from 18th century Italy. On entering the room, a quote reads, "Many a man's heart has been kept wandering by the bow on his wife's slipper," a sentiment more or less true even today. I ask one couple what they think about the exhibition they've seen.
As a man, I appreciate fashion, and I see shoes as a reflection of other parts of fashion, like hemlines going up or down would affect, obviously, the shoe, things of that nature. So, yes, I have a great sensitivity for fashion, so that's why I would be here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think it's it does incorporate history, and, I mean, you get an understanding of where these designs came from. They're not just something that somebody dreamed up. They actually do correlate with the history that and the time period that they come from.
Meanwhile, Sonia Bata is delighted by the visitor response. She tells me that, in fact, many first-time visitors underestimate the significance of footwear, and they're stunned by what they learn.
They tell us that they never thought that shoes were really so interesting, because shoes tell you more about people, their activities, the culture they live in, the status in society, than any other object of material culture. They are very surprised.
Eventually, I come to the end of my visit, but make a point of seeing the celebrity shoes section, especially enjoyed by kids. Somehow, however, after the moccasins and the European buckles and bows, I'm not quite in the right frame of mind, although there's no denying the elegance of flats that once belonged to Marilyn Monroe, or white sneakers that belonged to the real Slim Shady, Eminem. One last thing does interest me, and that is whether the museum has original Bata shoes from that region of Southeast Moravia where Bata's original business was born. Sonia Bata again.
Well, the shoes we have got are from the late 19th century. As you know, the Bata Company was started in 1894. And really how Tomasz Batia made his money was by offering shoes at the very low price. And he was able to achieve that by making men's shoes, for example, which were actually textile shoes. And they did have an artificial sole on it, a man-made sole. And then they had some leather pieces sewn on the top. So they looked like a brogue or like a normal lace-up shoe. But it was in brown and beige textile material. Mm-hmm. And so this is how he achieved this low prices that people could afford to wear. This was really the original Bata production when they started to industrialize the workshops in Zlin.
Today, you can buy Bata shoes just about anywhere. But the Bata Shoe Museum in Toronto is unique, both as part of the cityscape and from the moment you cross the threshold. You can find more information at www.batashoemuseum.ca.
And that's all from Radio Prague for today. From me, Pavla Horáková, and all of us here, bye-bye, and we leave you with a bit more of Sam Roberts, a group whose album We Were Born in a Flame is still one of the best recent albums to have come out of Canada.